Welcome to the Crypto Noobs podcast, where we break down this new fascinating crypto world to make sure everyone new to it can understand it better. We think that by breaking down what feels noisy and complicated into first principles, we can all make better and more informed decisions. My name is Gabriel Riesco, and I'll be co-hosting this podcast with my friend Alex Fuchs. Thanks for spending time with us. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Crypto Noobs podcast. How are you doing, Alex, today?
Good.
Good. What a beautiful day here in Connecticut. Sunny and...
spring.
Yeah, what a gift, huh? Yeah. All right, so let's get on with it today. A lot of interesting things to talk about. I want to start, actually, with this very interesting concept, especially now in this environment, crazy environment with the war in Ukraine. Of this concept that I just heard of seeing Bitcoin more of as a weapon, right? And the way I understood this, Bitcoin is so resilient, and it's an outsider. It's like an outside rails out of the SWIFT system, so it's not controlled by any government. It's completely decentralized. And it's a way where you can transfer money and value pretty fast and pretty secured. So it's kind of like a wall. I think of like the Constantinople wall, very, very resilient. But at the same time, I also think of it as a Trojan horse because it can really reach to any corner of the world. So I want to ask you, Alex, what are your thoughts of this concept of Bitcoin as a weapon? And what is it that you think can change the financial systems or even the world? What is the potential or the role of Bitcoin on this environment?
Yeah. So I think that first calling it a weapon is probably bad PR, right? So
I agreed.
I hear the concept. The I think, other ways that this has been said is things like Bitcoin is inevitable, or Bitcoin is a standard, or the Bitcoin standard, back to Seif Dean's book and some of the others. But I think the idea is that, and we've talked about this before, is what Bitcoin enables, what the blockchain enables through its through the mechanism of Bitcoin, is peer-to-peer store value, transactional system, and that means that you bypass a significant amount of the established system, which in some cases can be very beneficial, but forgetting that, from a technology point of view, it is, if you want, the highest and best use case, or the technology that empowers the most simple model, right? So the idea is that over time, when you look at measures, right? So for years, people had different coins, people had different units of measure to go out and measure distance, to go out and measure time zones or clocks, and so on and so forth. And one of the magic about having gone forward in the modern era is having decided on certain standards of length, a meter, again, in the US, the imperial system. But pretty much when you go out and do engineering design, when you go and do any work in construction, manufacturing, whatever it is, pretty much anybody who is involved at a professional level will work off similar standards, similar systems. And what we have in the financial system, as we are seeing now through a lot of the restrictions and the sanctions that have been put on Russia, we're starting to understand a little bit more mechanism. But basically, we have a fairly antiquated system that has been kept the same, that forces you essentially to use the banking system to do pretty much anything. So if you are a company and you're paying for supplies, if you're doing your payroll, if you're doing many things, whether as a company or as an individual, you are interfacing with a financial system which already exists and which has, demonstrable inefficiencies at all levels. You don't have finality. You don't know whether something really happened go and verify that something happened. You're taking the word of the financial services company that you're using, but also in some ways, pretty much everything that we pay or everything that we do, we don't verify. Think of it this way, right? You send money to Verizon for your cell phone bill, but you don't go and make sure that they got the money. You just hope that they don't bug you again for more money when you told yourself that you, when you told your bank to pay it, or you paid it, or you used some kind of system to do it. All these systems kind of are external. They're not, you can't really code around them, meaning they can't incorporate them into things that you want to build relatively easily, which is why, you know, things like PayPal came about and other kind of facilitators, but it's not a really easy direct access to the payment rails, right? So what this does, what Bitcoin seems to be, and again, remember back to the concept of network, in order for money to work, in order for something like this to work, you just need users. And the more users you have, and the more you have people who agree that this is a standard they're going to use, then the more utility the network has, and therefore, you know, the more you can achieve the things. Think of the internet. You know, you could create, and people did create, and companies created for years, internal ways for them to communicate if they had the money and if they had the will to go out and create telecommunication systems so that they could more easily communicate between the London office of, you know, an airline company and San Francisco or every branch, wherever. You know, there are many of those systems that were created in order for some businesses to be able to do things that the internet now does. Those existed before, but they were not standardized, they were extremely expensive, and obviously you did not unlock all of the value that comes with having a standard that anybody can use. And that's what really Bitcoin is. And therefore, the issue becomes, as a incumbent, as somebody who already has so much at stake in the existing system, which is things like, you know, the Federal Reserve and banks and commercial banks and lenders and insurance companies and many of the companies that by definition have had to adapt to the existing system and to try to use it in whichever way they did, those people are resistant to thinking of having a new or probably are not seeing more easily all of the long-term value, all the possibilities of the unlocked value of what's in, you know, this kind of new system. And when people say, you know, it can be used as a weapon, or they really are thinking about how to try to find ways to use it to gain power early, and to be able to have some kind of position in it. So the argument is, you know, Jason Lowry and some of the people that we've talked about make this argument that, you know, countries, institutions should be starting to stake their claim to part of the landscape in Bitcoin, which basically means, you know, get a meaningful position in reserves of what may be the new standards, particularly now where it would be relatively cheap to, you know, and again, it all depends on market liquidity and whether you'd be able to buy it at, you know, in size, but that, you know, even as a defensive mechanism, many players, geopolitical players, countries, people, you know, people or institutions or companies or governments who are afraid of being tied to the old system may want to have a meaningful position in Bitcoin, or to have reserves, or to have this. And that was illustrated, obviously, on both sides of the conflict in Ukraine. In some limited matters still, because it's obviously not a very high adoption rate.
Yeah, that was a comment from, it was Jason Lowry? Is that what we're talking about? Yeah. That's a very interesting point of view, because one of his points is that, you know, when a technology like this is presented to you, his point is like you can't really afford to say no, because it's gonna backfire you, and you're gonna pay a big price. And it seems that Bitcoin can really reach to any corner of the world. So to his point is like if you don't get on board early, you're gonna pay a big price. And it seems like the warfare now, it's not so much physical, but it seems like we're going to the finance, exactly, the financial warfare, right?
I mean, this is a thing which is, you know, kind of, which is kind of funny, right? So we've talked many times that clearly it's not assured that Bitcoin may become a standard or may have a universal successful replace or rise to the level of the current financial system. This has not played out the same way that many things don't play out until they play out, right? So the question is really, people who are convinced are not thinking necessarily, you know, of risk. There is a percentage probability this will happen, right? Which they may ascribe to be 100% fine, and which, by the way, Peter Schiff, other people may ascribe to be 0%, right? But both of them in some ways are wrong, right? Because the probability is somewhere in there. When people say that Bitcoin, for example, as an investment, is an asymmetrical risk opportunity, is simply because they think of multiple of value if it actually does happen compared to the price of where it is and your allocation and so on and so forth is very attractive. There's much more upside than there is downside, even if the downside is 100%, right? Simply because if you do an, you know, kind of expected value of all the outcomes, you think you're ahead.
Yeah, and that makes sense in a way that Bitcoin is very, very early on. So if Bitcoin just becomes the size of gold, you're there, like, yeah, the asymmetric. That can happen.
Right.
And if it happens, I'm not saying that the probabilities of that to happen, who knows?
It's whatever, yeah.
But that's the asymmetry, that it's, if it happens, it's going to go up significantly.
Exactly. Let's put it this way. Think of it as risk as a continuum, which is, I think, how anybody should look at it as a risk manager, right? Somewhere between 0 and 100% is the chance that this will happen, which is not saying much, right? It's either, what we know is that it's not 0 or 100%, right? It's somewhere in the middle. It's a network. It adopts more people or less people every day, you know, have Bitcoin addresses or use it for transaction or use it for store of value or use it for whatever it is. And there's plenty of arguments. It's not a very good unit of measure. It's not a very good transactional system. People, you know, in this phase don't really want to spend their Bitcoin as an active payment method because they want to hoard it, whatever it is, right? But the point is that it's not 0, it's not 100, it's somewhere in the middle. Now, depending on where you think it is, now it starts becoming interesting, because if you knew that something had a 5% chance of being, you know, the new standard, then now there are certain players in the world that can't take a 5% risk. They have to allocate something to something that has a risk of being 5%. Think of it as like insurance, right? So like you buy insurance because you think there's a 1% chance a tree will fall on your house, but you still pay it because it's normal for you to do it.
So you're saying that institution or big money or significant money, it's gonna be a defensive move on their portfolio, and that's a significant amount of money, right?
Exactly. And Lowry's point is that countries themselves have to face this risk, right? It's the same thing as stocking on antiviral drugs or masks or whatever it is when there's no pandemic, just in case there is one, right? There's a lot of cost that comes into trying to deal with tail events or with low probability events. So the question becomes, if you think there's a 1% chance that Bitcoin will work out, then yeah, you can kind of ignore it, right? As soon as you get to 5% or 10% or 20% or something like that, then the problem is that many, many, many players have to start thinking about it in a different way. It doesn't have to be 51% for people. It may be for, you know, retail and for the average person and for you to be able to win an argument at Thanksgiving, but you know, 51%, the game's already played, right? On the way to this, to whatever the natural end value of this, right, which is again going to be 0 or 100%, agreed, in the end it's 100% or 0, but it's not that now, right? On its way to that, it's like a presidential election. You think there's a X% chance on the way to there will be a president that will be one of these two people. So now you have to start playing your cards as the chances of one, let's say that you're a political donor or whatever it is, you have to start playing on probabilities. And playing on probabilities is the theme of this part of the cycle, right? We're clearly in a space where it is higher than the 0% perceived chance that Bitcoin will have a massive role. There's enough money, enough time, enough people that have joined the network and used it. And there's enough, you know, relatively positive comparison to existing alternatives to make it something that can be very powerful. But we're definitely not in the, 50% or 30%, whatever it is. I mean, we're in kind of some level of probability, which means that some actors may want to play in a certain way, and it could be in some way self-fulfilling.
Yeah, the thing is, it doesn't have to be massively adopted, but I think going back to the risk reward, just if it becomes an asset class, and just one more, like real estate is an asset class, it's $100 trillion market cap, and gold is what, around 9, 10, whatever it is. Well, bonds is $600 trillion, right? So, but even if it's a small asset class, the asymmetry is huge. And to that point, I think what's interesting now with the war is that actually you're hearing like Putin and Biden, they're talking about Bitcoin. It's not something that it was in their speech 5 years ago.
At all. But we talked about this before, but the thing which is, which is funny, but the adopting, well, let's put it this way. Bitcoin doesn't really care about what happens around it, right? Because again, there is no promoter of Bitcoin, there is no central unit of Bitcoin. That's a concept that's really difficult to get your arms around. There is no company that promotes Bitcoin. It's not like Ripple, XRP, it's not like...
But there is a community, though.
It's a community, it's a voluntary community of people who probably, certainly, on average, have very little control over the future of the protocol, right?
But they're cheerleading.
Cheerleaders exist. Yes, yeah. It's a little bit like fans, right? I mean, like there are a lot of people who like Tom Cruise or like the fans of Taylor Swift don't have a huge amount of influence on what Taylor Swift's next album is going to be about, right? At the same time, Taylor Swift has 100% control or X percent control, whatever it is, but majority control probably about how she decides her creative vision. The work on Bitcoin, surprisingly enough, was done 12 years ago, right? I mean, yeah, there's things happening, and I want to belittle the work of contributed developers, but, part of what is nice about it is that it's a very simple set of rules that a lot of people can understand, that have been established, that will keep on humming. And where the game theory has been done in a way where as soon as you gather some steam in the network, it's very difficult to kill the network. The network itself, with everybody joining the network and having something at stake in the network grows in utility. This is, Metcalfe law argument and all that good stuff, a little bit of what happened with internet or, cell phones or any of these things. More people use it, more people use it. What I think, people are uncomfortable with uncertainty. They don't like uncertainty. And inflationary times, for example, are very uncertain. They're the perfect example of uncertainty, right? Because you don't know how much you're going to get paid, you don't know how to set your prices, you don't know how much to push. In a perfect certainty where, in a perfect zero inflationary environment, then everybody more or less stays and you put your prices up and down depending on your utility. But now you have a treadmill, and now, for example, if, in the last year the average dollar has lost 7.5% of value, right, in purchasing power, whatever baskets, whatever your basket is, right, then, the world itself could easily have been in a real recession that is masked by printing, right? Because if it turns out that all, you know, think of it this way, right? If all value of all assets and of all things around here did not grow by 7.5%, right, then basically on a real term, the pie has shrunk in terms of value because now it takes more dollars to pay for whatever it is, right? And I don't really believe that in most of the landscape. I think living standards are still growing. I think there's a role to technology. You can't have a conversation with anybody who lives in Ukraine right now, I understand that. But in the relative larger scale of things, and again being kind of an optimist, well, you know, like things are continuing the way they are. And therefore an element like, you know, it is a very natural evolution of the antiquity of the financial system, the lack of transparency, the bad behaviors that you've seen under the guise of trying to do social engineering a little bit on the financial side through easing and so on and so forth. It would not be surprising to me that 5 or 10% of the world wants to think in this new term, and you know that's way more than you need.
A new term, you're talking about Bitcoin or crypto. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let me finish with a tricky question. What would you say to someone like Peter Schiff that says that Bitcoin has zero value, that the value is zero, it was always zero, and it's pretty much air?
Sure.
I mean, what would you say about that?
I think it's super easy. I think that if you own a stock, right? If you own a stock, you are coming at the very end of a long line of claimants on the profitability of any company, right? Like, first you have the cost of the business. You know, the company will take in revenues, and after the revenues come in, then there's whatever cost of delivering the services, and the employee costs, then taxes, then, you know, debt payments, creditors, then any of things that can happen. You're sitting at the very end hoping that something is going to happen. The hope that you have is that if you're a shareholder of Apple, yeah, you're going to have some dividends perhaps, and you're going to have some growth, and you're going to have some. The whole system has existed for years on.
And you're going to, yeah, and you're going to hope that someone pays more money than what you pay for the stock, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know.
Which is his whole point of attacking Bitcoin, by the way.
Well, no, it's the same thing. The point is that it's the same thing with gold. It's the same thing with everything. It's been hundreds of years where perceived value is the value of something, not the intrinsic value. Once again, 85% of the value of gold is non-intrinsic, is not industrial use.
Speculation, pretty much, right?
It is some level of speculation, some level of additional value that the market participants ascribe to in equilibrium to something that happens to be a metal out there. You could easily have a multiverse or some kind of other universe where, you know, it's not gold, but it's whatever else, you know, people are trading rubies or whatever else may be scarce enough to do it. Imagine this, the concept of diamonds. There's a massive, you know, kind of diamond industry that's out there, which is literally controlled in a oligopolistic manner where, you know, constraining supply makes something have value that literally can be synthesized, right? Built out of thin air, and on top of which the real true supply probably is nowhere close as restricted as what you have out there in terms of consumer supply.
That's interesting.
So, like, that argument doesn't hold water for anything. It doesn't, you know, the corollary, the opposite is not helpful. It doesn't kill the fact that Bitcoin could be worth zero. Right, he could easily argue that Bitcoin is worth zero for many other reasons.
Well, yeah, for a Martian, gold can be zero too.
Right, exactly. Like there are other reasons. I'll give you one for fun. Right, like tomorrow we find out that the U.S. government actually, in some way, was at the origin of Bitcoin. Was, you know, it was a very small project that nobody really cared at the time because clearly the market cap at the beginning was like, you know, zero. So, you know, like who cares? Or, you know, some very intelligent person could have come up with this, and then it turns out that the United States government owns all those fantastic Satoshi million BTCs, and that tomorrow it decided that it wanted to get out. There is no liquidity in the Bitcoin market whatsoever to be able to handle one person trying to dump a million BTCs. I mean, you know, if you do that enough, you could see a $50 BTC without any problem, right? There are many other risks, they are low probability risks. They are, in my mind, incompatible with the logic of how this would have happened. There are many reasons why I don't think they have an impact on the overall way, but there are many ways to argue that Bitcoin has no value, right? You could even argue that, there are many ways you could argue some of, like, let's go back just for fun on the energy argument. We talked about this before. Yeah, of course, Bitcoin uses a huge amount, shit tons of, unnecessary energy, because it is exactly at the time in the network when it needs to prove itself as being secure. So yeah, there's way too many miners who are guessing at nonsense stuff in order to be able to, we talked about the game theory mechanics of how the mining works, which is nonsensical when you think about, yeah, if I lived in a control panel of life, if I was God and I was able to just secure the network without having to spend all the energy, yeah, of course I wouldn't use all this energy. But the whole point of where Bitcoin is now is that the majority of people believe that it's not a network, that it's not, that it's not a solution. So the only way that the protocol, that the system, that the software, that the design works is by saying, well, you got to spend a lot of energy in order to secure the network, and that will, over time, go down as the halving goes down, as the rewards per blocks go down, and therefore there's a solution built into it to the energy problem. Yeah, it doesn't look good now, maybe, but again, the rewards go down by half every 4 years, and the network has not established itself as being secure enough, even if probably it is a million times over-secured when it comes to the amount of hash power that's there trying to do something, again, difficulty adjusts to the amount of hash power.
Anyways, that was a interesting answer. Thanks for that. But no, I agree 100% on that. I do see, personally, I do see the value just on it's software. It's pretty much software. So if you think that software has no value, then well, that's your opinion. I don't see much much validity there. Whether people use the software or not, that's a different story. But they're obviously using it. That's why Bitcoin is at 40,000 right now. But anyways, thank you so much for all your insight again. And we'll do that next week again.
Yeah, we'll talk about Chinese stocks next week.
That's right. All right, that's an interesting one. Don't miss that one. That's a mind-blowing one. All right, have a great day, everyone.